The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But first, as you've heard in the news, a magnitude 8.8 earthquake struck off the Russian coast overnight. The quake has triggered tsunami warnings and advisories around the Pacific, from Japan down to Hawaii and up to the United States and the Canadian West Coast. We'll have a deeper look at the earthquake with Professor Chris Bean in a few moments. But first, we want to get updates from reporters around the regions affected by those tsunami alerts, starting with Pixie Clay, Managing Editor of Hawaii Public Radio. Pixie, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, can you tell us what is the state of things at the moment in Hawaii? What are they telling you? What are they warning you about?
We just got a latest update from Dr. Chip McCreary. He's a tsunami expert with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He said the max amplitude of the tsunami has already passed, meaning the worst part of the tsunami has already come and gone. And so we're on the tail end of the tsunami event right now. What we saw was some inundation and rising tides and flooding waters, mainly around all the coast of all the islands of Hawaii.
So in the end, it was not as dramatic as had been feared.
That's right. But, you know, we don't exactly know how big these tsunamis could be until we get the waves at the islands. We can see, you know, the measurements from the buoys all along the way. But because of how the land is around the islands, it changes the way the waves comes in. And plus, along the different coasts, there's a lot of different, you know, alcoves and bays and cliffs, and the way that it shifts the water and the energy of the water flowing towards the islands.
Now, did many people have to evacuate in fear of what might happen?
Yes. So anyone who was in a tsunami evacuation zone, which they have, we have maps and you can input your address and you can find out exactly whether or not you're in a tsunami evacuation zone or not. Everyone was advised to get to higher ground, and the evacuations started as soon as it became a tsunami warning around 2 p.m. local time.
The speed of these waves is quite enormous when they occur. I presume that there are no hardy or mad souls out there trying to catch a wave.
Police have been very proactive in trying to get people off of the beach and out of the water. You know, there's usually one or two people out in the water attempting to catch a wave or surf in these emergencies. But because of the magnitude of the earthquake that happened, we were very concerned that it was going to be a big tsunami event. And so they got everyone out of the water and took everyone away from the shores as quickly as possible.
Now, how common are these kind of warnings in Hawaii? I mean, do you get them regularly?
So we have a system where it's four levels of warning. There is, you know, a watch, where is potential it could happen. There is an advisory, you know, which is like middle ground. Warning is the maximum threat level. And then the lowest is a threat, which is like potentially could happen, maybe not. A watch is, you know, watch in case it could happen. Just on Sunday, we did have a tsunami watch that happened because an earthquake did happen in the same region of Russia. But within a couple of hours, that was canceled and we had no tsunami activity from that.
But you live, or your islands are in an area of pretty active seismic activity, I suppose.
Yes. And because, you know, we're basically in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Whenever there's an earthquake anywhere around the Pacific Rim, basically they're watching for tsunamis that would come towards the island. So the last significant tsunami event that happened in Hawaii was in 2011, when there was an earthquake in Japan. And prior to that was the 1960s, when there was a big earthquake off the coast of Chile.
But it's all clear now. The peak has passed, so people can relax and return to their homes, I presume.
Right. Well, not quite, because they don't want to have everyone rushing back to their homes and into the waters. Because the tsunami is technically not over yet, the currents could still be dangerous. So they're trying to get people away just in case and just to be extra safe.
Pixie Clay, Managing Editor of Hawaii Public Radio. Pixie, thank you very much for joining us on the program. Well, next we go to Japan and Martin Fackler, Acting Tokyo Bureau Chief with the New York Times. And Martin, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing there? What's the status of the tsunami warnings in Japan?
Well, we had a pretty big alert go out. Japan, of course, is a frequent target, is that the right word, of tsunamis. Mm-hmm. We had a fair number of alerts. I was here in 2011 when the big tsunami hit. It was about 15 meters tall and killed 20,000 people. So they take these things very seriously. And we had a warning go out for almost the entire Pacific coast of Japan. The warning was for waves of up to 3 meters. And in the end, they came in at about half that height maximum. The tallest one was about 1.3 meters that was measured.
I presume, though, even at 1.3 meters, you've got people evacuating because even that can more than get your feet wet. It can destroy property.
Well, I think that, you know, Japan is, we just had a very lethal tsunami in recent memory. So people are very, very careful as a result of that. And in that tsunami, they first said, this is 2011, they first said 3 meters, and they said 5 meters, and then finally they said 10 meters. And so to avoid a repeat of that, where it kind of snuck up on them in terms of size, they erred on the authorities erred on the side of caution. And about 1.9 million people were told to head to higher ground as a precautionary measure.
And what about at Fukushima? I presume that is as vulnerable as ever.
The plant, Fukushima Daiichi, they evacuated the workers who were down near the seaside. As you may recall, the tsunami in 2011 took out 3 nuclear reactors, which were all located along the Pacific Ocean. And so the workers who were involved in that decommissioning project, who are actually taking apart or trying to get to the point where they can take apart the reactors, they were evacuated as a precautionary measure. And, you know, it was all on the coast. I mean, anybody who was close to the ocean was told to go to higher ground. In Japan, that usually means going to a school, which tend to be built up on high ground, or to a park. And we did have some reports of traffic jams, of people trying to leave. But fortunately, nothing really serious happened.
So has the all clear been sounded at this stage?
Not yet, because the nature of this particular event off of the Kamchatka Peninsula up in Russia, there is the possibility of tsunamis coming in hours later. And so, for example, I mentioned the 1.3 meter tsunami that came in several hours after the first waves hit. And so there is the potential of yet another round of waves coming in at some point. And so the all clear has not been given. And, folks here are on standby, really, to make sure that something worse doesn't happen.
As you point out, you can have a secondary quake after the first major quake, again, which can generate, in particularly when the water has been disturbed by the first quake. They've got to watch what hydrologically might happen.
Yeah, because it really has to do with how the surface of the sea bottom moves. And I haven't seen what happened there. In 2011, the bottom of the ocean moved almost 100 meters. So if you can imagine the surface of the Earth moving the length of a football field, and it moved that distance in about 1 minute, in about 60 seconds. And that movement is what triggered the tsunami. It was just an enormous displacement of water. And so I'm not sure what happened off Kamchatka. I haven't seen I don't think we really know what happened. And so people are erring on the side of caution.
And wisely so. Martin Fackler, acting Tokyo Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Martin, thank you very much for joining us on our program this morning. And finally, we're going to Steve Futterman, a U.S. West Coast correspondent in Los Angeles. Steve, good morning.
Good morning.
So has there been a tsunami warning in California?
Yes, especially in the northern part between San Francisco and the Oregon border, north of San Francisco. There's a city called Crescent City that has just a horrible history when it comes to tsunamis. In 1964, the city was basically destroyed. This was a tsunami, or what they called back then a tidal wave, from the very great Anchorage earthquake in Alaska in 1964. Much of the city was destroyed, and there was significant damage in 2011 from the sun. Sunday earthquake in Japan, a tidal wave, a tsunami, we called it by then, hitting Crescent City. So that's an area right now. Now, at the moment, it's in its area of concern right now. The tidal waves, the tsunamis are supposed to be hitting right now. And of course, as you've heard from other reporters, it's not always the first wave that causes the most damage. In 1964, it was the fourth wave. So right now, Crescent City, the Northern California area, which has been under this tsunami warning, which is the highest alert you can have, is sort of in its area of most vulnerability right now. And it will be that way for the next few hours. But right now, no indication of any serious damage, any serious waves hitting the coastline at this point. But again, it's in this 2-3 hour period right now that they're concerned about.
Now, in this part of the world, when we get storms and so on, there is a certain amount of flooding damage. And it's possible in this part of the world to build flooding defenses, but you can't build defenses against tsunamis.
Oh, that's right. I mean, if you've ever seen the picture from the Sendai earthquake and subsequent tsunami in 2011, it's one of the most frightening things you've ever seen in your life. I'm sure many people have seen it. It was just a shocking video. You're right. If it's big enough, there's nothing you can do to avoid it. Obviously, in places like Hawaii, I know today they were giving people a warning to, if you're in a high-rise building, be above the fourth floor so you can have some protection that way if you're in a high-rise. But if you're in anything lower than that, and you have a giant, giant tsunami, there's not going to be much to really protect you at that point. And that's why they tell people to go to higher ground. And again, in areas like Crescent City, which they are used to this, they had an earthquake there, I believe it was last year, where they had a very quick tsunami resulting from an offshore earthquake from Crescent City, and it caused some damage. Now, there is going to be very possibly some minor damage in various areas. Even here in Southern California, where I'm at right now, there's a possibility of some relatively minor damage, but nothing like what we're talking about when you have a massive tsunami hit an area and you have death and destruction.
And finally, Steve, do people take these tsunami warnings seriously? Or, in the wildfire situation, you have some people who say, I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying where I am.
I will say this, in most of California, probably not. I mean, if you have a houseboat in San Francisco Bay, maybe you take it a bit seriously. I think because of the magnitude of this quake, I think it's been various 8.8, 8.9 magnitude. Because of that huge magnitude, I think maybe people took it a bit more seriously than they might otherwise. An area like Crescent City that's been hit before, yes, they take it there very, very seriously. But I have to be honest with you, but in the last few hours, as the period of vulnerability, as I call it, approached, there was only that brief area in the Northern California section above San Francisco to the Oregon border that had what's called a tsunami warning. Most of these other areas had a tsunami alert, which is a much less urgent distinction given by the Weather Service. So I don't think those areas took it that seriously. I know here in Southern California, maybe some of the surfers were hoping that there would be some big waves in the morning in Malibu, things like that. We have actually seen that happen before when the Sunday earthquake hit. There were surfers, I know, in the West Coast who were hoping for some nice waves to surf on. But again, except in that area in the northern part of the state, which has been hit before and had that tsunami warning, I think most of the state took it pretty much for granted that they were going to be okay.
Steve Futterman, U.S. West Coast correspondent in L.A. Steve, thank you very much for joining us. Well, now we're joined by Professor Chris Bean, Professor of Geophysics at the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies. Chris, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, 8.8, I know because of the nature of the way these things are measured, isn't it logarithmic, that it's hard to know. What does 8.8 mean compared to, say, 7 or 5?
Yeah, well, so if we think of trying to relate one earthquake to another, you're absolutely right. It's a logarithmic scale. So a magnitude 8 earthquake, for example, is 10 times bigger than a magnitude 7. And a magnitude 7 is 10 times bigger than a magnitude 6, which means a magnitude 8 is 100 times bigger than a magnitude 6, for example. So as you start to get up into those numbers, you know, the things, as you get into the bigger numbers, like the 8s and 9s, you know, the small increments in those scales start to make a big difference, because you're multiplying by a factor of 10 between an 8 and a 9, for example.
So this one is huge, absolutely huge.
This is a huge earthquake. It is the fifth biggest earthquake ever recorded in modern times in the last 130 years. We'll remember some of the other big earthquakes that are relatively recent. The Sumatran earthquake in Indonesia, which was in 2004, that was a magnitude 9.1. The Tohoku earthquake in Japan, it was just mentioned, the tsunami there, your previous speaker mentioned that, that was in 2011, it was a magnitude 9. And the next biggest earthquake, actually, which is interesting, is also in 1952, was in Kamchatka, which was right beside the earthquake that has just occurred there. So this earthquake occurred on what's called a subduction zone. So it's where the Earth's crust, the Pacific plate, is pushing underneath the North American plate. Now, that might sound confusing from the geography point of view, but the North American plate actually, as it's officially called, actually extends deep into Eastern Russia. So there are two plates, one is going underneath the other in this subduction zone, the kind of ring of fire area. When these plates rupture, the entire plate doesn't rupture at any one time. Patches of it go at different times. So in 1952, a patch of this big plate went in the Kamchatka region, generated a magnitude 9 earthquake. This recent earthquake, another patch, the neighboring patch actually, which looked like it was ready to go, there was a lot of stress building up on it, it went and generated this magnitude 8.8. But just for some perspective, like this earthquake, the patch that ruptured was about 700 kilometers long and along in one dimension. And then as you go down into the earth, it was about 220 kilometers wide. So you're looking at a patch of earth, two plates that are rubbing past each other, with a 700 kilometer long patch by 220 kilometer long region. So I think that's at that area actually rubbing past each other, rupturing. And it took the guts of 3 minutes to rupture. So the thing is that the rupture, the sliding, is traveling at about 4 kilometers per second as the two plates slide past each other. So it's an absolute, it's a massive event.
It's also incredibly quick. I mean, the idea that anything's traveling at 4 kilometers a second is astonishing, and such a large mass of material in this plate traveling at that speed is terrifying.
It is terrifying. It is terrifying. It's actually controlled by how quickly kind of ground-shaking waves can travel. And because talking to somebody in the air, the sound is traveling at about 330 meters per second, which is fairly slow. But when you get into the ground, waves can travel very, very fast because it's very dense. And they can travel, you know, beyond 4 kilometers per second, but that kind of controls the speed at which the ground can actually rip apart as well. You're basically ripping the thing apart, sliding things, making a crack that's sliding, one side of the crack is sliding across the other, and that's controlled by how fast sound can travel in the ground, which is about 4 kilometers per second, or 4,000 meters per second near the surface where this happened. This is interesting. Sorry, Pat,
The question really is, if we know what happens and we know the area is potentially vulnerable, is there any way we have probes down there to give us an early warning?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and it's kind of the holy grail in the earthquake world was to actually say, you know, give us a time, this event is going to go off tomorrow at 3 o'clock or in the next 1 or 2 days. And it's extremely difficult to do. In fact, it's actually impossible to do at the moment. But what we can do is we can say we know the regions that are very, very hazardous, and we try to build the infrastructure to withstand the biggest earthquakes in the world are very difficult to build infrastructure against, but the moderate-sized ones we can. The reason why it's so difficult is that it's like the straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, you have, it's very difficult to measure all the details that you need to know. You know, how strong is the rock everywhere? How much stress is on the rock everywhere? Not just generally, but at, you know, at every meter in the rock, how strong is it? At every meter in the rock, how much stress is on it? We can't measure that in detail, and those details matter because the system is kind of unstable. You can think of it like that things that can get triggered by, like the straw that breaks the camel's back. So you're loading up the rock with stress. But then this tiny extra load is enough to set the thing off. And once that sets off, it loads up the neighboring parts of the rock and they load up their neighbors and the whole thing just runs away on you and you can't actually stop it. So it is, it's because the thing is kind of in a way critically unstable. It's very sensitive to small changes that it's very difficult to predict when exactly it's going to go off. So we get the general idea of the regions that are actually dangerous, but predicting exactly when something is going to go bang and just run away on you is very, very difficult, are actually impossible at the moment.
All right, Chris.
So that's our goal, but that's one of the goals. But unfortunately, that's not achievable. So we need to look at it more from a hazard point of view rather than a prediction point of view.
Chris Bean, Professor of Geophysics at the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.